Hello and welcome to Towards the Point, a cultural compass for Pompey and beyond. I'm James Sandy, and in this, the first show of our fourth series, we get around and look up with an update on a new pop plaque project for Pompey. We talk Alias and Roy Orbison with the magic numbers as they drop into Pie and Vinyl, and we consider the place of cafe culture and the cult of the cappuccino. Joining me, as ever, is the pompadour of the pop conundrum, part-time psychological tourist, and the best-dressed raconteur of the Portsea set, it's Dave Allen.
Hello, James.
He's back from his summer break in Gosport or somewhere.
Cricket grounds.
You can find links to all the show topics and the archive of previous series through our blog, towardsthepoint.blogspot.co.uk. We start tonight with Geopop in the shape of an interesting new project around pop plaques. So kind of blue plaques, but different from that. And we're very excited to have Nigel Grundy, who's a curator from the Guildhall, Portsmouth Guildhall, creates the Portsmouth Pop Music Experience Access All Areas. That's the full title. I think exhibition. I got it in there, Nigel. Exhibition. I missed the word exhibition off the end. I nearly got there. But Nigel, welcome to Towards the Point. Tell us a bit about this plaque project. It's really interesting.
Well, having grown up in Portsmouth and Southsea and thoroughly enjoyed the 60s, it occurred to me that many of these places are no longer there. And last December I thought maybe we should do something about it, in as much as starting a blue plaque scheme. So my first choice was the obvious one of where the birdcage used to be, and I did a mock-up of a blue circular plaque, rather like English Heritage, and photoshopped it onto a photograph of the building that now stands where the birdcage stood in East New Road. And we talked about it, and the idea sort of rested for a while until, I think, early August, when Dave had an email from a local builder who said he owned the building and he'd quite like to put a plaque up commemorating the birdcage, which is a complete coincidence of what I'd been doing a few months before.
Serendipity, they call that, don't they?
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah. So that's where we got with it, really. So he's quite happy to do that, and it's quite a coincidence that that was the building that I was actually thinking of as well. Initially, we thought maybe we could do a publication with it, with histories of the buildings and histories of some of the people that have been in the buildings.
So I was just going to come in and say something there about the history, because one of the things that you're already doing is the curating that you're doing in the Guildhall show, so that people who saw those plaques, tell us about those, Nigel, because they could come down to the Guildhall show, and I mean, you did some lovely wall posters about a lot of those venues, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, we the exhibition's open normal Guildhall times, and we have rooms dedicated to the 1960s with venues, people, memories, a room dedicated to the bands that played at the Guildhall, a large exhibition area which is showing Tommy, 1974, when it was made in Portsmouth, and the memories of people. That came from the King's Theatre when they had Tommy on this year for 3 days, and they've donated the panels to us. And we've now decided to have another room in the Guildhall, which is just going to be a dedicated Tommy room. We've also built a 16-seat cinema, which is going to be used for the first time for the Making Waves Festival on September the 21st to 28th. And we're also building a recording studio, almost finished the control room now. We're also incorporating that. We're having an online radio station, Access All Areas Radio. So there's a lot of exciting things happening there at the minute. But one of the things, we've got a long corridor wall, which we call the Wall of Fame, and it's got photographs of Portsmouth musicians from the early 50s up to the 1970s. And it's packed with, there's not much room for another photograph. On the other side of the wall, it is very sparse, and that's from 1970 up to the present time. And I don't know why it is, but despite appeals in the paper and on radio and on TV, nothing is forthcoming. So whether people didn't collect the stuff, whether it was because it was digital or not paper-driven, or whether it's in people's lofts, I don't know. But we've got a long space there for people to put their stuff onto.
And that's kind of an appeal, isn't it? I know we've mentioned when the exhibition opened, I think beginning of last year, I think it was, when it opened officially.
A year now. Yeah.
Yeah, so we put out a kind of appeal, didn't we, in terms of memories and kind of nostalgic things that we can capture there. So we can do that again. You know, if people are listening to the show and have things that cover that period that Nigel's described, then do let us know. There are ways they can get to the Guildhall, or they can let us know through the radio.
They can email, it's aaa@portsmouthguildhall.org.uk, or they can bring things in and leave them reception. And we are finding that there's an increasing number of people visiting the exhibition in the daytime, and they're all incredibly grateful at what's been done, because it suddenly reminds them of things they'd forgotten from years ago, and it sparks lots of things in the memories. And people come for maybe a quick look around, and they're there for an hour sometimes, just talking to people that are around there.
I don't have any kind of clear evidence of this. It's just a kind of half-brained theory of mine, really. But, I mean, in a sense, you might comment on this, James, because you're clearly younger than the pair of us, quite considerably younger. And
on radio, age knows no bounds. No.
But I do think that, you know, I mean, we're both in our mid-60s, and I just think that you do get to a point in your life, it doesn't have to be that old, but you get to a point in your life where you where the memories are really quite precious and quite powerful, and they're one of the things that kind of keeps you alive, and you relive and rework them in certain ways. I'm not sure that when you're 30 or 40 that's necessarily quite such a driving force. That may be wrong, but that's one of the reasons why I wonder whether people are not turning up with the pictures of the bands they were in 10 years ago, because they're still forming another band and moving into their next future.
Yeah, but you, Mick Cooper and I have always kept things from the 60s.
Which it's true.
The exhibition is mainly made up of the three of us is
ephemera. Right.
So, you know, were we nuts or special for keeping it? I mean, did nobody else seems to have kept that?
Unusual, certainly. Unusual, yeah. And we do it in different ways. You know, I run the blog, and Nigel often sends me stuff about the Guildhall and the plaques to put on the blog, and people come. But all the people that come to the blog are essentially our age, aren't they?
Yeah,
and
very much so. Yeah.
What we need to do, I suppose, is find those two or three crazy 35-year-olds who are already emulating what we were.
Well, they are there. I mean, there's a couple of people which would like to help, but they've got very busy lives.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they say we've got all this information, and of course information needs processing, it needs laying out, and we don't have the time to do that because we're doing other things. I mean, the exhibition is run by trust members of myself as a curator. We've got Pete Cross, who used to run the Tricorn and other entertainment agencies. My wife, Audrey. We've got Mick Cooper, who of course is well known for what he does. And Phil Freeman, who was a singer with Soul Society and Image many years ago, and roadie for Gentle Giant.
I think for me, one of the things I consciously do, and maybe I'm one of those crazy people in the 30s, if you like, but one thing I consciously do is if I go to a gig, I always keep the ticket. I always keep the ticket.
That's the trick.
And stick it in the album. The easiest thing to do is just stick it in the album of whatever's current at that time. Also, because I've been, you know, since I've been in Portsmouth, I've been involved in various things, and I've been involved with sort of ukulele groups and all those kind of things. I've got posters from gigs that I've been at and played in and all those kind of different things. And I kind of consciously thought, well, that'll be quite nice one day when I'm, you know, when I'm in my 60s.
Absolutely.
And I'll find it in the loft one day. So,
absolutely.
So that I suppose people do, well, I do certainly collect bits of memorabilia, consciously or kind of subconsciously. But I suppose the other element to this is, you know, there's something about the digital record, isn't there, in terms of everything these days is online. And do people store, you know, or keep posters and things? It's very finite, is it? It's very instant. It's very kind of, you know, once the event's gone, you know, there might be some video of it somewhere on YouTube, but you don't get the kind of presentational stuff.
There's a trick to that in terms of the Guildhall exhibition, which is that if it's stored digitally on a JPEG or whatever, then most of what we're doing in that corridor of fame is reproducing digital images and getting them printed laser so they don't fade, and just literally pasting them up. It's like the biggest scrapbook in the world, isn't it?
Straight on the wall.
So let's talk about the plaques then, because you know, there's an official blue plaque scheme which English Heritage run in London predominantly and other cities, and Portsmouth has a number of those. You know, so there are, you know, there's Dickens, Peter Sellers, Kipling, there's those kind of things around. Tell me a bit about, I mean, from what you're saying, Nigel, these plaques are commemorating buildings or kind of gig venues, essentially. But plaques often talk about people, don't they? And or Conan Doyle wrote his book on this corner, or you know, kind of had a cup of tea here, that kind of thing. So, are you going more at the moment in terms of the venues? Is that what you're looking at? That kind of
not so much venues. I mean, it's also the places. You know, when you start thinking a bit wildly about it, where all the sort of grotty bedsits that people lived in the 60s, people that became quite well known in Portsmouth and nationally. So it would be houses. I mean, one of the other problems is trying to find people's permission to do it. You know, I mean, and we've got maybe English Heritage's copyright, so we may have to do a different shape. I mean, the Portsmouth Society, they do their own plaque for, you know, for the best buildings.
Yep.
So we've got to do a bit of research into what sort of form the plaque would take. The wording's quite straightforward because, you know, we all know about the wording to go on there. So it's mainly colour, shape, and also financing it, because it'd be quite an expensive business to do it. And also researching who owns buildings, also if there's any planning permission required. So if George Langton, who is the builder who owns the building where the birdcage once was, if he puts his plaque up, that's great. And if there's time and money coming from different directions, maybe we could think about other buildings as well. So initially, it's just to do with the birdcage, but it's such a delightful idea that it'd be nice to spread it further, even to the South Parade Pier.
I guess there are opportunities in kind of building that trail, if you like, across the city to bring back some of the, not the ghosts, but some of the people who, you know, performed or were involved.
There's two or three books about just pop trails in London, with photographs and maps, so you can go to London, you can do different trails, and you could do that here. I mean, there's enough places surviving and sites of that you could actually do quite a good half day walk round or drive round, and you know with a good illustrated brochure. But there again, it's finance.
So you mentioned the birdcage, and you know, Dave and I and numerous other people have talked about that in the past. And in fact, there was the mod book, wasn't there, recently, where you know there was the
Paul Anderson's book
about the birdcage and all those kind of different things. And you know, that's an obvious, I suppose, an obvious one in some ways. What kind of other sites were you looking to kind of include?
Well, other big sites. I mean, the big ones were places like Kimball's. Mm-hmm. Kimball's is still there, but I think it's a casino now. The Indigo Vat was very big in Hampshire Terrace, but that's now Scandals.
Mm-hmm.
I've been down there since recently, and it's very much still very much like the Cavern.
Mm.
But the little tiny stage is now a dance area, and we're talking only a few feet square here. It's very small. Places like the Soul Parlour in North End, which was I think it was a post office club when it was. And Lynn used to hire it on a...
She certainly hired it, yeah.
Yeah, it was a post office club, I think. Yeah.
It's above the snooker hall. Yeah.
It's still there. Mm-hmm. I mean, places like that. Even St Nick's Youth Club.
Some of the youth clubs.
Some of the youth clubs.
The old Oddfellows Hall in Kingston Road, which was the Rendezvous Club and is about to be an old people's home,
which we
joke about quite a lot, you know, because we think, we're going to end up there as well.
I've had a look around it, because I was... standing outside, asked one of the builders if I could talk to the owner, because I wanted to go inside and have a look around. And it's been beautifully redesigned as an old person's home.
Mm.
Fish tanks around the outside walls. And he's spared no detail. I mean, the marble entrance where it was chipped, he's spent a lot of money getting that repaired. The original staircase up there is still there.
Yep.
But the dance hall is now maisonettes, two flats.
Yeah.
He spent about £15,000 having the doors reproduced that were on there originally, these glass plain Georgian doors. Absolutely beautiful. It's a fantastic redevelopment. And I talked to him about, he wanted to put some form of commemoration inside the doors about what it used to be. So we're doing something with him as well at some time.
I thought Nigel made an important point when he said earlier about the fact that this isn't true everywhere, but the fact that in Portsmouth, most of those big venues of the 50s and 60s have gone. The Savoy on South Sea Seafront, which was opposite the pier, which is just flat at the moment, but eventually it will be built up. The South Parade Pier, Nigel said, you know, well, that was a key venue. One of the few remaining venues that still has its same function, although it's changed its name, is what was the Co-op Hall in Southsea in Albert Road and is now the Wedgwood Rooms.
Mm.
And that was a venue in the late 50s and early 60s and still going. But it's one of the few, isn't it?
It is, really, yeah. And I was standing outside this morning when I had just come out from the hairdressers, and I was looking at it and I thought, I actually played there, my recorder in 1959.
This
is your recorder band.
Still counts.
Yeah,
still counts.
Yeah, still play there. Yeah, yeah.
What about people and incidents? You know, things that people have done in the city. I read just before came into the studio. I read that to commemorate the life of Rick Mayall, the late Rick Mayall, somebody on Hammersmith Broadway, which was famously at the beginning of Bottom, the sitcom that he and Ade Edmondson were in, and they used to sit on a bench and sort of, you know, hit each other. And the blue plaque, the unofficial blue plaque, said Rick Mayall was hit in the balls by his mate here, and then it just had his you know, kind of his dates, if you like. And I just thought that's quite a nice, you know, it's obviously done as a bit of fun, and it's not a permanent fixture. But are there sort of people and incidents that you'd like to commemorate
I
as well?
Like Dave, there's a lot of people I love to remember, a lot of people I don't want to remember,
a lot of people you'd like to hit in the balls.
So whether you put plaques up to both of them, I don't know. But,
brilliant.
But yeah, there are people that we collectively remember, and that's the funny thing about those days, really. I mean, there's a lot of people whose names you didn't know, you just knew them as being people that were around, and now somebody's photograph will come up and say, do you remember this person? And you do, but you don't remember what their name was. So a lot of people are unnamed, really. I mean, also, there's a coffee bar in Palmerston Road called the Manhattan, which is one of the biggest coffee bars that we used to go to. It's a real good mod coffee bar. I think it's now a gift card shop.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a very important venue, so I have a plaque up there. And also, of course, the Guildhall. What I've been talking with the Guildhall about is putting a plaque at the side of the Guildhall in the stairway the Beatles came down when they finished.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the stairway opposite Wetherspoons, and I know that because I was outside when it happened to skip my homework. You were in there, Dave, weren't you?
Yeah, I was
you
in
got
there.
A ticket.
Yeah.
I was outside.
Yeah,
but
he was playing drums, I think.
It was very interesting. There was maybe 1,000 people outside without tickets, and there was a corporation van outside the entrance, and somebody broke into it and found some jelly babies, and the Beatles had transferred to this green corporate van on Porch Bridge and come to the Guildhall like that. And when they left, they dropped the curtain, put on She Loves You, the record. Everybody thought it was an encore. They rushed out the side door, and I was outside, and they managed to get in the only car whose petrol tank hadn't been filled up with earth in Victoria Park, because the idea was to stop them getting away. And they actually got in there, drove down past the Wetherspoons, is now the old gas showroom. A couple of girls threw themselves in the road, car stopped, we all crowded around it, girls got moved, and off they went to stay at the, it was the Royal Beach Hotel.
I think it was.
And the first time they came here, at the Savoy, they stayed at the Keppel's Head on the Hard.
Yeah.
So where are we with this project at the moment? There's lots of great ideas, and there's lots of, as you said, funding's an issue.
Yeah.
Well,
it's not so much for George Langton, because I think he said, in your email to you, he said he was happy to pay for that, didn't he?
He did, which was lovely of him.
Yeah.
So that one can go ahead.
That goes ahead.
So it's kind of growing the trail or the or
yeah.
The,
I mean,
the
that's that, that you know that's sort of the team leader at the minute, mm-hmm. and depending on that one goes, and depending how much enthusiasm people have got to chase up all the other questions and finance amongst all the other things you've got to do.
So are you looking to build an army? Is that what your appeal is? You kind of trying.
Well, I think it's possible that we'll get sponsors. You know, I mean, we're not sure about the cost of it yet, but you know, I'd certainly look at sponsoring something like Kimball's or the Rendezvous, which are, you know, were early magical places for me.
If
so,
we could just get a basic pattern that all changed with the text. Mm. I mean, you know, there again, if you go 3D with the text, like, you know, it's going to cost more money.
Yeah.
If you just get something that's like a good image that's laminated.
Mm.
And put on the wall that's weatherproof, that might last 10, 15 years, that's another matter.
And the other lesson we know from Peter Sellers elsewhere is
put it very high up.
Put it high up so souvenir hunters don't pinch it immediately.
Corner Castle Road, that's always, always going, so it's got higher and higher and higher, whereas now you've got a job to see what it says.
Yeah.
A soapbox, I think that's what you probably need.
Yeah.
Okay, so Nigel, it's great to have you to come in. Where can people kind of get in touch with you, find out more through the Guildhall? Is that the best
place? I think probably through the Guildhall. They can come into the Guildhall, into the exhibition, or they can leave something at reception, or leave a note at reception, or they can send an email to aaa@portsmouthguildhall.org.uk, and someone get back to them if they leave an email message or a phone number, something like that.
Excellent. And I will await the day that a plaque goes on this very building we're recording in, which says James Sandy and Dave Allen argued lots about Bob Dylan here.
Probably more about cricket than Bob Dylan.
Nigel, thanks very much.
Okay.
Cheers. You are listening to Towards the Point with me, James Sandy, and Dave Allen. And at the end of last month, I was very lucky to capture the magic numbers in Pi and Vinyl for a great acoustic set. And here's how I got on. Well, how lucky am I? I'm in the back room of Pi and Vinyl yet again, but this time I'm with the magic numbers, who are Romeo.
Yeah.
Michelle.
Hello.
And Angela.
Yes.
And you've just finished playing a very intimate set.
Yes.
A charming set as well. You've got very warm vocals.
Thanks.
Is that a good description? I hope it is.
Yeah, it is.
It reminds me of honey and syrup.
Hopefully not too sweet.
So, let's start by talking about the new album.
Yes.
Tell me about the title of the new album. It's just an intriguing title.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it's called Alias. And I guess it's a reference to the fact that we can be several people at the same time. There's lots of facets to everybody's personality. When you're around different people, you're someone else. When you're on your own, so. And I guess as well, that seemed to reflect the mood of the record in terms of the different styles on there, and just us as a band, sort of reinvention of the group.
So different masks, almost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or more of our real faces.
Yes, exactly.
More. I knew it was intriguing. I didn't know it went that deep.
Oh, it goes very deep.
It goes even deeper.
All the way
deeper
to even deeper.
Tell me about the cover as well. It's got a great cover, which I'm going to describe it, but it won't do it any justice. It's a kind of collection of monochrome passport photos.
Yes.
But there's some people. You're on there. I've spotted you on there.
Yeah, we're
there's
on there.
Sort of extended family members on
there.
Are they other friends or
lots of friends,
people that we don't actually know, friends of friends or yet to meet.
A few fans
on there
throughout the whole thing within the booklet.
People who've worked on the record as well.
Yep.
And I think just basically everyone that we've done it as part of the album and that can make the album theirs as well. You know, just kind of wanted a lot of sort of snapshots of people at a certain time in their life.
Whilst you're touring, you snuck into those photo booths and just found people's pictures.
Yeah,
well, like in Amelie, where he's
a couple of them are very found
catching all the photos underneath.
Yeah.
No, we didn't do that.
It's more coordinated than that, which is good.
It would be a good story though if we did do that, but we didn't.
You mentioned the mood of the album. Now, obviously, you've been away for a little bit because you've been doing fun things like having children and extending families further.
Yes,
but you're back, and that's exciting. Mm-hmm. How's the mood of this record different, would you say?
People have been focusing on the fact that it's a darker kind of record, and I think, you know, it probably is in places. But I just think in terms of the sound of the album, it's got a lot more energy than we've ever captured on record before. And that was something that we tried to achieve. We were like, we want to try and get that spirit, that place that you get to when you're playing live, and it's just that unconscious feeling. So having our own space allowed us that. So, I guess it's a bit darker. I mean, it's a lot guitar-led, and then one side of it, and then the other side's much more orchestrated, big productions, and it's a soulful record, you know? So, but I kind of always feel like all our records kind of have different
sounds,
sort of things to it, so it's hard because I'm attached to it to sort of nail that, but I leave that to you and whoever listens.
Loads of people listen, obviously, but a lot of the reviews I've read today have said that this is your most confident record.
Yeah.
Now, I get what they mean, but I'm sort of reading around that a little bit more. I think this is, for you, I think it's one of the records that kind of captures your kind of live sound best. And you just touched on that in your answer, but it's kind of, you know, there are differences, aren't there, from obviously studio and live and all those kind of things. But you seem to be making that transition, that kind of that mid space.
I mean that was
a bit of the magic, maybe.
It was the moment where we kind of were, I guess in the studio we kind of were going for that moment where it's spine tingling and you just forget yourself, you close your eyes and you lose yourself in a moment, and to capture that on album, on a record, is really hard. And we wanted to just sort of just do like a couple takes, you know, two takes, three takes, and just listen back and go, that's the one.
It has that rawness to it,
coming from our last album, The Runaway, which was more sort of orchestral, and we tried out a lot of different sounds on that as well, so it was just like, I think all the albums that we've done before was like a learning process in terms of recording and sonically in the studio, and this one we've captured the band live, you know, energy and
it's
everything.
Distinctly you as well, I think. You know, there's some different things on this album, and you know, there's some experimentation, but there's that thread, which is great, because that means you're kind of still in touch with you know, what you've been doing, which for me is a real positive thing.
Definitely.
We're always there, you know.
That's good. One of the tracks on the album, A Shot in the Dark, which has been, I think, the first single off the album. There's a local connection, which I only considered when I was walking down Castle Road. The end of Castle Road is where Peter Sellers used to live. Shot in the Dark was the second Pink Panther movie.
Didn't
even occur to me till I walked around the corner.
I'm gonna have to watch
Pink Panther as well.
Well, there you see. That could be a special edition single or something, couldn't it?
But, you never know.
But that song is a bit more about, I suppose, taking a risk and kind of in relationships and.
Yeah, I mean, basically in life, really, no one knows what, you know. We're all sort of searching for things, and we're all kind of thinking that we're in control, but we're not, and no one has any answers, and you know, it's kind of but the thing is, it's not a dark take on it. I mean, it's like an inner monologue to remind myself that basically we're all in the same situation. We're all shooting in the dark. We're all sort of stumbling, trying to find our way. And when you acknowledge that, you can actually take that moment to sort of have a bit of clarity and, like, you know, go, okay, I'm not going to have that panic attack that I was going to have a second ago.
Now, I don't know if everyone realises this, but they should realise this, but the magic numbers, the core of the magic numbers, there's a sibling effect, isn't there?
Yes, of course.
There are two sets of brothers and sisters, to break it down, to explain to people what on earth I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And how's that helped? Do you think it's helped the band, or has it been a barrier?
I feel like musically it's great. It's so instinctual, and, you know, we kind of bounce off each other, and we're able to say our ideas, just, you know, or tell each other to, that's rubbish, or, like, you know, and just be ourselves around each other, where I think a lot of bands kind of probably aren't.
I think that family tie, though, as well, it means kind of we're all kind of in the same kind of mindset that we want to do this for as long as it takes, and not as long as it takes, for as long as we're living. And I guess in that way, with a lot of bands, things happen along the way, and I think it just makes us stronger. You know, kind of, you can have arguments, but you'll always come back. And
I think as well, what's going to be important in the long run is, like, Michelle's made a solo record. We're all doing different things. This band is this band when the four of us get together.
Exactly.
It is, you know. So I'm going to want to do some other stuff. So is Ange, but it's always going to come back to this thing, and hopefully every time we come back stronger. Yeah. So
there is an energy when we're playing together, and no one else can really touch that. So we've got to keep going.
There are always four corners, aren't there, in the dressing room, which is good. So you've each got one to hide in.
Usually a corner for all the bags, mainly my big bag.
Who gets
and
who dressed?
Ashley
takes
the
over
corner.
The whole dressing room. Is the point she's trying to say?
Yeah.
You,
my dressing room.
You open with a song, Roy Orbison, which is a homage to a great.
Yes.
And I think rather cunningly in that song, you've worked in some of his kind of rhythms.
Yes.
What you restricted yourself from doing, you didn't do the Mercer here like that. although at one point I thought you were going to go down that route. But,
you give me something to tell him now to do on the tour.
But he's got to get in there now.
It's a great, great song. And I think it's difficult, isn't it? Because, you know, someone like that, an icon like that, it's difficult to kind of pay, I suppose, through a song, it's difficult to pay kind of respect, and homage is the right word, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know, without it sounding kind of trite, if you like, but you've managed it, so congratulations. That sounds a great song.
Thank you very much. I'm really proud of that one. It was kind of just how it all sort of happened. When we were recording it in the production sense, it was nodding more and more to crescendo and the rise. And
Drove All Night was the track that was in my mind. That's what I was kind of thinking. I like it.
So good.
So you are at the moment touring, and you're covering pretty much all the bases on the map.
Yes.
So you're doing Glasgow, you're doing Liverpool, you're doing Bristol.
Right.
You're coming back to the Wedgwood Rooms here in Portsmouth on the 24th of September, which we're all very excited about.
Yeah.
You're doing the Forum in London on the
25th,
and then from the 27th of September, you're off to the rest of Europe.
Yeah.
Off to the cafes and prison bars of the rest of Europe, but I'm sure they won't have pie shops.
The one thing about being
find
back in
pie and vinyls.
The two combined is great.
It's great.
Sure.
Winning combination.
I mean, you play in lots of different places, and you're kind of big and small. Is there a strangest place you've played?
Well, somewhere that's taken to us in a really massive way is South America. It's amazing. Like, if we want to have a little ego boost, we go there. You know what I mean? Like a little sort of...
feel like we're the Beatles.
It's amazing.
Maybe they think you are the Beatles.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's always nice. But things have, you know... I'm glad that we've kind of, you know, stayed on our road as such. And there's loyal groups everywhere, you know what I mean?
Nice.
Like, so when we go back, you know, we recognise people and we see, like, you know what I mean? You're going to lose people along the way, and that's almost important because you kind of then, you know what I mean? Like, you find
their way.
Yeah.
You gain a few though as well.
And then they may come back to stuff or may not realise, oh, bloody hell.
Yeah, so I think it's good to try and play different places and different rooms. You know, like last year we did an acoustic tour.
We played
loads of seated venues.
That was something
we'd never done before. You know, I've never done actually an acoustic tour. So it kind of opened our eyes in certain areas that actually was really wanted us to come, you know.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we'll definitely be doing loads more sort of shows like that again.
Now, you mentioned earlier in your witty rapport with the crowd, we're going to call it that, that you had, the honour of touring with Neil Young, or playing a couple of dates with Neil Young. And you mentioned... You told a story about kind of coaxing him into your dressing room with your magical tunes, which I think is a feat in itself. But I guess people say to me, never meet your idols, you know, because you'll always be disappointed. Mm. Neil Young's up there as one of my idols.
Oh, 100%.
You wouldn't be disappointed.
No, he's got the air of the most kindest, sweetest soul. He has a real zen-like presence. He's got this so within himself, like... He's just doing it. And the thing is, you always kind of know that anyway, being a fan into his records. He's just living it. But he exudes that, so it's really inspirational. But you know, we had some nice moments together, but that was a moment that we had, you know, it was
kind
of, we
made that moment happen.
So that was my kind of thing about making little moments happen.
I think orchestrated or otherwise, it happened.
Exactly, that's the main thing, it happened. I got to shake his hand.
Next time you see him, send him my love.
Yes.
Okay.
But until then, Magic Numbers, Romeo, Michelle and Angela, thank you so much for your time. Great set, and best of luck with the new album.
Thank you.
Fingers and everything crossed. I think it's going to do really well.
Thanks very much.
Take care.
Thanks.
Cheers.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
You are listening to Towards the Point with me, James Sandy, and Dave Allen. We move now to coffee and Wi-Fi and cappuccino, all those kind of things that I get stuck in on a day-to-day basis. There's a new place in town, and I went along and spoke to the folks at South Sea Coffee Company about cafe culture and the cult of coffee. Okay, so it's really hard work for me because I'm at the back of South Sea Coffee Company having an Americano, and I'm joined by Martin Knight, who's the owner. And I was amazed, we were talking just before we switched the mic on. You've been here just over a year now. South Sea Coffee Company's Osborne Road in South Sea. How did it come about? How did things materialise?
Well, my wife's background is in restaurant management, and she fell pregnant, to which we have a lovely little son. And she went back after her maternity leave, and there was kind of a hole missing in her life. She's quite a driven woman, and she just had this passion, and she decided that third wave coffee was something that she wanted to do. And yeah, sort of 3.5-4 years down the line, here we sit in the coffee shop that we carved out of nothing, really, which is...
So that term, third wave coffee, that sounds like an indie band. So to the uninitiated, to the uneducated, what does that describe? What does third wave coffee
mean? Third wave coffee, let's deconstruct it a little bit. It's simply the latest incarnation of coffee culture. Coffee's kind of been on a bit of a boomerang journey, really. Started perhaps in Australia, New Zealand, etc. A lot of Italian migrants took with them their own coffee culture. You know, the Italians, you know, the Italian coffee isn't everyone's favourite. However, they do have a very strong coffee culture. Cafes are a very big business. You know, people find time to drink coffee and converse. What happened is they took this overseas with them. It's kind of morphed or developed or sort of grown, and it's kind of boomeranged back to us. And, you know, it's something that now is very important, really important to the independent farmers. I mean, our coffee here, we can trace back to individual farms in various places, because coffee is seasonal. So our coffees change as our menu changes, you know, that come in season and out of season.
So that provenance is really important, isn't it, in terms of kind of ethos of what you call third wave coffee?
Yeah, I think it's become, people have been a lot more understanding about seasons. It's not just a generic product. Even what we call our house blends change. But they taste the same. They are blended slightly differently with different beans throughout the year to achieve the same taste. And the company we use is a company called Hasbean, who are based up in Newcastle-under-Lyme. Great bunch of people. They've been fantastic in supporting us. And the guy, there's their sales manager, a guy called Dale Harris. Now, Dale recently came second in the UK Barista Championships. So this guy really knows his coffee. You know, he's a top man. And so basically they blend it to have... similar characteristics of notes for the certain blends. And then of course the single origin coffee, the stuff which we use in our filters, just changes as it, like African or the South American, and that's completely different. That is a world of taste if you like your coffee.
So do you find people get confused when they come in, because there's an array of choice Yep. They think, I just want coffee. It should be wet, hot and black.
That's absolutely fine. We can accommodate everybody. And one of the things we wanted, I think a good analogy, actually, if I digress slightly, is to go back as wine was 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. If you walked into a public house and you asked for a glass of wine, red or white was probably the answer that you got back. And if you look at certain wines, you had Blue Nun and Black Tower and Liefrong Milk. Coffee's doing the same thing, and now it's developing. People are actually much more aware of a product that they want. So one of the things in regards to the shop that we wanted to do was to make sure that it was accessible to everybody. In no way would I consider us to be pretentious or above anybody, and we're more than happy to guide people and give them the information to let them jump in feet first. And
well, it's interesting you say that, because I think, you know, generally sort of in the popular media, if you like, there's this vision of coffee shops, which I think is brewed up mainly from Central Perk in Friends. Yeah. And the coffee house, I can't remember the name, but the coffee house in Frasier. That's kind of people's ideas of what coffee houses should be. But there's that mixed with, as you've just mentioned, the kind of connoisseur, the wine tasting folk, but also the stamp collectors in there, I think, as well. There's this kind of nerdy aspect to it as well. It's a mix of things, isn't it? But it's changed beyond those.
I think it's... This is the metamorphosis of third wave. It is a bit of everything, you know. If you want geeky, we can do geeky. Most people don't. And, you know, all most people want is really tasty coffee. So it doesn't matter for most people, providing the coffee is good. Some people thrive on it. The stamp collector will, you know, and they'll want the exact weight, the exact volume of water, what time did the shop run through at. We can do all that as well. But you can get lost in coffee. At the end of the day, it is coffee.
You were saying that part of your success story is kind of simplicity, trying to keep things simple. When you go in a large high street chain coffee retailer with a large green logo named after something in Battlestar Galactica, that's all the clues I'm going to give.
Yep.
They are at pains to write everything down on your big tall cup, what you're having. But you've got a more simple approach.
Yeah, these people are designed for high volume. They, you know, they want you in and they want you out as well, because they're it's just literally turnover. One of the things we wanted to do with the shop was like an old-fashioned hospitality approach. I mean, we know, I would say, 80% of our customers, which I think is quite good. You know, people like us, people come back, so we're kind of doing something right.
It's a relationship thing.
Yeah, and with your comments on Central Perk and the one in Frasier, it's simply because that, you know, coffee houses have a history, if you look at their origins, of being places of quite radical pure thought and heavy debate and stuff like this, and they are, I would actually argue, kind of replacing the pub. You know, the old fashioned local where people just used to turn up to have a couple of drinks, not get drunk necessarily, but have a couple of drinks and chat and interact, and it's been whittled away, have actually disappeared. So I think that, you know, the rise of the independent, especially in connection with its local area, is very, very important to fostering relations and being part of the community that they're involved in.
Is this now where stag nights come to get wired? You know, they're on caffeine, maybe. Is that happening?
Yeah, I mean, it's just sort of... It's fascinating. Our customers range from British Olympic physiotherapists to art students to graffiti artists to, you know, to mums to... Literally so across the board. We know this because we're having relations. We're talking to them. Which is important to us, not just a bucket of hot slop on the side with, you know, caramel lattes on the side of it.
So there's something really interesting there, I think, and you mentioned it when you mentioned mums, you know, because coffee shops, good coffee shops, good independent stores like yourself, have this very much kind of social focus and the kind of, it's very pro-family, and I think that's a kind of, maybe that's a bit of Italian feedback. You know, there is this adage, if you go in an Italian restaurant with children, they clear the restaurant for you, you know, whoever's in there, just out the way the kids are in. But, you know, there are some pubs and restaurants, sadly, in England that don't do that, but it is very much about kind of social fabric.
I think, you know, what you know, if children are a future. That's a very, very bad Whitney Houston line, I know, but they
we
are.
We can play that,
however, it's sort of... Yeah, they are part of our social fabric. You know, I have a 4-year-old boy myself, but I don't want to sit there and have a coffee in crazy caves. I want to sit in a fairly adult space which is tolerable for children, and that was kind of the ethos with the shop. You know, we have areas for children to entertain themselves. We have a little den in the garden that we built for them. Because, you know, if you have children, sometimes you want to just take time out and sit and get a nice cup of coffee. Certain major chains just don't cater for you. They have so many seats crammed in. If they have buggies and everything else, you just can't get your child in and out of the shop without perhaps it being a major event. So most people tend not to bother.
I thought the Den was for stressed businessmen to,
occasionally,
to relax.
Yeah. It's always available for hire if anyone feels they need to.
Let's talk a bit about the revolution and some of the planning and plotting and things that go on in here. There's a few creative strands of activity that you've established. There's a wall in particular that we're sitting quite close to.
You know, the shop kind of has two very distinct areas, the front bit and then the area which we refer to as the snug. Yeah, and there's a wall which must be 12 foot long and about 8 foot high. And we tend to treat it as a blank canvas, as in we have inquiries from local artists and stuff who want to put their own work on it, and which we let them do, providing we feel that it's appropriate, not offensive in any way, but we kind of hand it over to them, and it is a blank canvas for them to do with what they want for a couple of months, and to promote the sales and the local art scene. You know, I mean, Southsea is very, very lucky, I think, to have a very, very good underground art scene. There are a few good artists. There's a place called the Coast Guard Studios just up the road, which again supports local artists and is very proactive on the scene. And we like to support them and give them this canvas to sort of to show themselves, really, without it being at sort of at cost. You know, we pay for the materials for them to do the art and then just enjoy it while it's there. But it is, however, a transient piece, so it's not there forever. You know, 8 weeks and then it's gone.
And you're documenting some of that, I think. Photos and
yeah, we're going to
have a very imaginative Tumblr website. Not many people use Tumblr, but
well, I think that you know, in fairness, that all belongs. My wife is phenomenal with social media, both Twitter, Facebook, and Tumblr. She's really, really good. She's and Instagram, of course, is the photo one. But yeah, we sort of, I don't know, we are a business. And we have to be a business, you know, we have bills to pay like everybody else. However, it was always going to be for us a lifestyle choice. Mm. You know, we have a young family, it's about being able to appreciate our son growing up and be there for him and, you know, and then have a place that we want to work in, you know. I mean, it's like myself and a good friend of mine, Glenn Allen, and we built the shop. I mean, I don't, when we came in, it was an old Holland and Barrett shop, so we had to literally rip it right back. And it's kind of very flattering when you get people who ask who our design agency was and who was it was just myself, Glenn and Tara, my wife. You know, we did all of it, the branding.
It's kind of like the wild frontier, isn't it?
And
build a house and kill an elk.
Absolutely.
Or something.
Absolutely. People thought we were balmy. Absolutely balmy, because, you know, they didn't necessarily see our vision or, you know, and what we wanted to do. And it's become its own entity, really. I was sort of talking to someone the other day. It's kind of developing in its own way. Like the food, especially, is because we had limitations. They wouldn't give us like a hot kitchen because we have whose premises above. And so yeah, we've doing a lot of sort of like raw and vegan food, like vegetarian food. And it's just up and running, and it's quite phenomenal, really, at times, to just sort of take a back seat. It's easy to lose sight of it. Sometimes you've got to step outside and look at it and then keep it in context. You know?
You mentioned the kind of mix of people that you have in the shop from day to day. Have you got particular groups or community groups or gatherings that have started to use you as a kind of host venue?
Yeah, we do. I mean, we've had some that have kind of outgrown us, really, which is a positive thing for them. It's just sort of like a mother and baby group, and like Southsea Slings, and we had like a women's recovery group that was using this area, because we don't actually charge for hire in the area, we just let them use it. But obviously, you know, we're limited by numbers and stuff like that for safety reasons. But yeah, a lot of them become too busy. We've been sort of too successful for them, and they've just been attracting too many people for it to be viable anymore. Which,
and that's a very good thing. I think too much success is a good excessive place to be.
Yeah, it's but it's like, you know, it's we have to understand who we are and where we've come from. We are just a little coffee shop. We're not any, we don't have any delusions about trying to be something else. But that's not to say that our products and the place itself, we don't feel really, really proud of. But yeah, it's sort of, you're working with people, so it's never dull. In one way or another, it's never dull.
It's been great to talk to you. Just to finish up, I'm really interested to know. I've just had an Americano, a straight Americano, i.e. no milk.
Yep.
What's your favourite tipple? What's your preference?
I would like, if it was my last coffee on earth, would have to be something done with what they call a pour over, which is very, very gentle. It's coffee which is ground, put into a V60, and a certain amount of water just drizzled over the top so it will filter through. That's it, just black, no milk, no sugar.
See, that's simple but specialised, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, why make it complicated? Why there is? It doesn't need anything else. It is complete, you know, which is kind of perhaps a good analogy for the shop. It's like, you know, we digress, but we won't digress, if that makes any sense. There is a paradox there.
Well, listen, Martin, it's been great to talk to you, and I will let you get back to the beans and the filters and all those kind of wonderful things.
Yep.
And I wish you every success for the shop. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Lovely talking to you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Just before we go, we've just got time to catch up with a number of events forthcoming. And Dave, you've been exploring something at the Pallant.
I have. There's an exhibition which is actually finishing in about 3 weeks' time now. It's a very interesting exhibition by a Scottish painter. And I said to you earlier, I thought there hadn't been enough about Scotland in the media lately, so let's get this one in. Not a man I know a lot about, really, but his name's J.D. Ferguson. He's called a Scottish colourist, and there's a lot of, in his work, there's a lot of influence of Impressionism and Cézanne and Fauvism, and some of it's quite wild and lively. And a couple of absolutely fascinating pictures, which were part of... he spent most of his life in France and also obviously in Scotland and in London. But at one point, during the First World War, he was commissioned as a war artist, and instead of actually going off to the trenches, he followed the Navy around Portsmouth Dockyard. And there are Portsmouth Dockyard pictures there, paintings of mostly of ships and cranes and funnels and things, but they were kind of, that particularly fascinated me. So it's J.D. Ferguson, the Scottish colourist, and it's on until the 19th of October at the Pallant Gallery in Chichester.
Excellent, that's definitely one to lurk out. If you fancy going along to Havant Literary Festival, you can catch Will Self, the author himself, on Saturday the 11th of October. He's going to be reading from and talking about his new novel, Shark, which is the sequel to Umbrella, as well as all the other things that he gets up to. I mean, he knows a bit of a dangerous man.
He is a bit of a dangerous man, I think. Something much less dangerous. The 60 Plus Festival is being run again by Paul Smith.
Oh, I don't know.
And on Tuesday the 14th, at the Guildhall, adjacent to all the exhibition rooms that Nigel's been talking about earlier in the show, I'm running a kind of giant skiffle orchestra morning. And the idea really is that you don't have to be able to play too much, really. By the end of the morning, if you've got a guitar, we'll teach you three chords and we'll all play Freight Train or something and just have lots of fun. If you can play a bit, that's perfectly fine, but it's definitely not one for any Eric Clapton wannabes. It's people who want to come and have a bit of fun and join in and play a bit of skiffle. And while I'm rabbiting about all of that, I would like to wish Shep Woolley, one of the great stars of the local scene, a very happy 70th birthday before we next meet.
Wow, there's another plaque maybe in the making there. So if you fancy something a little more advanced in terms of the guitar and the acoustic sound, you can catch the Straubs, who are playing at the Cellars on the 3rd of October. And if you like something a little more artistique, as we say, you can go along to Cinema Number 6 at the Dockyard, Saturday the 4th of October, and see Luc Besson's new film, Lucy, which is an intriguing piece, I think. I'm going to try and get along to see that one myself, because it's got Scarlett Johansson, Morgan Freeman, and various other luminaries, but it's in French, so I'll have to take my reading glasses, as ever. That's it for this show. We'll be back on the last Monday of every month at 7 o'clock. There are podcasts and a whole archive of our three series to date, and the new series we've just started on our blog. You can find the links there at towardsthepoint.blogspot.com. Our thanks to Nigel Grundy for coming in and tell us about the projects he's working on, to Pie and Vinyl, and to South Sea Coffee. And as ever, my thanks to Dave Allen for helping me keep it together or thereabouts. Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.